Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to the second last edition of Risky Business for 2008. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by the wonderful people at RSA Security, which is, of course, the security division of EMC these days. It's been a very slow news week again this week, but we've still got a great show coming up. We'll be chatting to Gordon Lyon, who's better known as Feodor. He is the creator of the Nmap network scanning tool, and he's coming onto the show to discuss his new book. It's doing really well on Amazon.com, with the average review being 5 stars. Way to go, Gordon. Not surprisingly, his book is all about Nmap and network scanning, and it's already been described as the one and only authoritative reference on Nmap. And that interview is coming up after the news. Also this week, we take a look at some survey results. Australian Federal Police Agent Nigel Fair, who's been a guest on this program before, well, he's just released the results of a computer security survey he did off his own bat. So it's one of the few times when we've got access to some information that hasn't been released by a vendor pushing their own agenda. You know what I'm talking about. IPS manufacturer survey finds 99% of market requires IPS. Those sort of, quote, surveys, end quote. Greg Singh from RSA will be along to discuss the results of Nigel's survey in this week's sponsor segment. Now, before we get into this week's news segment with Munir Katadia, there's a fairly pressing item that just hit my desk, and I thought I'd give the Mac-using listeners out there a bit of a heads-up. So if you are an Apple user and you're running PGP for mail.app, you're in store for some headaches when you install the latest OS X update to 10.5.6. It'll break your mail. Hooray for Apple! To get mail to work again, remove the pgpmailleopard.mailbundle from /library/mail/bundles, and Apple Mail will work again, but alas, the PGP plugin will be gone, which really sucks, and there's no news on a fix from PGP yet. Fun and games. But right now it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with ZDNet Australia's Munir Katadia. Now, Munir, before we get into this week's news headlines, I suppose it's as fitting a time as any to announce that you will no longer be ZDNet Australia's editor, Munir Katadia, when you appear on this program in future.
I won't be. That's right. Yeah, my last day is effectively Christmas Eve. So next time we chat, I'm going to be, well, I don't know what I'm going to be, actually.
Well, there you go. I like how it's effectively your last days on Christmas Eve, which means between now and then we can probably find you at the local pub. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's media, mate. A very busy time for media in Australia coming up to Christmas, especially in tech media. Look at all the big stories that are happening. Although, thank God to Telstra for keeping things ticking over. Jeez.
Did you say thank God? We were trying to wind down, but then that happens. And so, yeah, it's as busy as, you know, middle of June. So it's pretty scary.
Well, anyway, on to things more security-related,
yep.
And that zero-day exploit that supposedly affected Internet Explorer 7, apparently it affects all versions of Internet Explorer. Hooray!
Yep. That's right. I was just looking, actually, and also put up an alert a couple of days ago, just basically saying because a patch isn't available for this, they recommend that people use a web browser other than Internet Explorer.
Wow, someone actually finally made that call, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know how practical that is, to be honest. You know,
no,
I mean,
not. There's so many people with lockdown environments that they can't load another one up even if they want to.
But, yeah, but I mean, that's on an individual case-by-case basis. But in an enterprise where you're managing 30,000 desktops, do you really want to spend time rolling out 30,000 new browsers? You know, that's just going to be an impossible headache.
Yeah, pretty much so. Maybe people should plan this next time they're doing a major rollout and have more than one browser.
Yeah, well, I mean, someone actually suggested that to me, is that in the future there'll be 2 browsers in SOE, so next time something like this happens, you can actually just switch to the other one. But then you've got to worry about supporting 2 browsers. It's a bit of a hassle.
Yeah, it is a bit. I guess it depends on how much you trust your users. Are they going to click on smut and other stuff?
Probably.
Yeah, name most of the users out there, yes, at
yes,
some point.
Yes, and we're talking about you. Now, in this latest bit of fascinating government news, again, a slow week, Kevin Rudd, our dear leader, our Prime Minister here in Australia, is hiring a security CIO to handle government security stuff.
Yeah, that's right. National Security CIO, going to be part of the National Security and International Policy Group. And, I don't quite know what he's going to do. Is he going to, like, go and chat to Wilsa and, you know, DSD and those other guys and make sure that the policies are all adhered to, or what?
I really don't know, and it's going to be really interesting to see what sort of person they recruit into that role. Obviously, it's someone that we'll be working very hard to get onto the program to have a bit of a chat. But, you know, we just hope it's not one of those career bureaucrats who's basically got to where he is by kissing ass and never saying anything sort of meaningful that could be construed as controversial. So, you know, that's the problem with these sort of positions, isn't it?
I think you ought to apply for it, actually.
Yeah, right.
Totally.
I don't think I'd pass the background check, mate, to be honest. But, I don't think I'd be doing that. But, I have a feeling that we're going to wind up with a bit of an empty shirt. But, with any luck, it'll be someone good. But who knows?
Yeah, who can tell? I mean, I guess it's good that they're taking it all seriously and stuff. But I don't know how much of this is just hot air.
Yeah, well, we'll see, won't we? But, I mean, I suppose it's good for the government to have a single point man, you know, because you do have the DSD, you do have AUSCERT, which is sort of like a weird quasi-government, privately funded, strange, registered business name of the University of Queensland thing.
Yeah.
Hey,
whatever happened to GovCert?
You mean Steve? GovCert's pretty much one dude at the Attorney General's department. It'll be interesting to see if someone can liaise between all those groups and if even that position's warranted, but I guess we'll stay tuned and see what happens. Now, look, before we get to that final story, HD Moore has released this week an interesting little bit of technology called the Metasploit Decloaking Engine.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. Apparently, if you're using Tor or proxies or whatever, it can still figure out where you are and who you are.
Yeah, now I remember doing a story about Tor about a year ago, actually. And yeah, I mean, it was well known that you could basically trick a browser into giving up your actual IP. Tor is supposed to, of course, obscure that information from the server that you're visiting.
Yep.
But he's written a little bit of, Flash/Java/whatever the hell it is that you can embed in a page and it will tell you the true IP of the person visiting.
So come on, what is this actually going to mean for the users out there?
Well, I think it means you shouldn't trust Tor, really, unless you know what you're doing to the point where you're disabling the sort of fancy crap that runs in your browser that'll do this sort of thing, then, I think it's kind of a good thing that someone's actually written and publicly released a tool, which we know is probably already being used out there anyway. So,
Absolutely, yeah.
I think it's just another reason why, yeah, you shouldn't really, I mean, if you know what you're doing, you can anonymize yourself. If you don't, you can't. So yeah. I think that's what this proves. But
well, good on HD Moore again.
Yes. I mean, man, he just keeps coming up with the goods this year. Now, in this final story, and it's not a security yarn, but we thought we'd actually take a look back over the last few months of layoffs in the among IT workers in Australia, and there's been a lot of them.
It's been pretty depressing, yeah. We've been running this little scorecard for the last month or so, and I don't want to the amount around there. We're talking thousands of look that they've already been laid off, and God knows how many will happen in the next round.
Yeah, so HPEDS, they've laid off 450 people. Optus has laid off 115. CAS, 100. Telstra, 800. Elders have laid off 40. There's a heap here with undisclosed written next to them.
Yep.
443 out of National Australia Bank, undisclosed from Optus, but you'd hazard a guess that would be a few hundred at least. So, it's a pretty tough time out there, isn't it, for all of our listeners?
It has. It's been a hell of an end to the year, really, and it's not looking good for beginning of next year.
Well, let's hope the worm turns, you know. I mean, it's going to be a tough year, I think, but, with any luck, we're going to see some of those people going back into the workforce.
Yeah, and it seems that we've not been hit anywhere near as badly as Europe or the US, so I'm hoping that we'll probably recover quicker.
Yeah, either that or we're just, the axe hasn't actually fallen on us yet.
Yeah, one of the two. We are slower sometimes in these things, aren't we?
Yeah, and that's a chirpy scenario. Well, look, mate, believe it or not, that's actually the end of the news, because I suppose it's not that surprising that nothing much is happening at the end of the year with 2 weeks to go. But mate, thank you very much for all of your contributions over the year, and I guess next time we speak to you, you're planning a bit of a trip to India, aren't you?
I am indeed, yes. So hopefully we'll be talking while I'm out there.
Yeah, we can have the sound of all sorts of
cows.
Indian stuff. Cows, yes. They like their cows, don't they?
They love them, yes. They just leave them alone and they wander around. It's fantastic.
Free range.
Don't go there.
All right. Yeah, no. Well, I suppose you wouldn't, Wrong country for that sort of quip, Okay, Moon, thank you very much again for all of your contributions over the year, and we'll speak to you again in February.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I look forward to next year.
For the last time in 2008, that was ZDNet Australia's editor, Mania Katadia, who's leaving that company on Christmas Eve. And we won't be running a news segment next week. We'll be releasing a Year in Review podcast instead. So again, thank you to Mania for all of his contributions over 2008. And before we move on to this week's feature interview, it's worth noting that this Internet Explorer bug that we were discussing is getting massively exploited out there. There are SQL boxes dropping left, right and center and being used to propagate this thing. Most of the time, a zero-day flaw is a bit of a fizzer. But whoa, not this one, let me tell you. So I think this this story, we like to think it's over, but there's still no patch, and it's all getting a little bit thick out there. Okay, it's time now for this week's feature interview, and our next guest needs little in the way of an introduction. His name is Gordon Feodor Lyon, and he's the creator of the Nmap Network Security Scanner, and he joins me now to discuss his new book. Gordon, welcome to the show. Tell us about your new book.
It's called Nmap Network Scanning. And I started the project in 2003, basically to create an official guide to Nmap and how to use it, you know, what all the options do, because Nmap's a pretty complex tool. But more than that, how you can use it effectively, not just tell, you know, what the min RTT timeout option does, but show how you can actually use it in practical situations to make your scans faster and more efficient. And so I told my users then, you know, be patient. Writing a book takes a long time. It'll be at least 6 months. And I was very right about that, because it was far longer than that. People were starting to compare it unfavorably with Duke Nukem Forever and wondering if it would ever come out. But I am really delighted that I finally did get it finished and in a state that I was really happy with and that was up to date with Nmap. And so it was just released just a few days ago, and it was the number one computer bookseller on Amazon yesterday.
Yeah, now I know just from speaking to you on IM that you've been a little bit taken aback by the success of this thing.
Yeah, it certainly was. It was really great to see it so high on the charts, especially considering what a niche book it was. You know, when you look at Amazon's top computer book sales, it's like, you know,
Windows for Dummies,
you know, blogging guides, Photoshop, you know, all these really popular mainstream things. So it was nice to see, you know, a port scanning book, you know, on the top of the list, at least for a brief period in time.
So you're going to be doing a second run?
I am. We're they ran out of stock, unfortunately, on Amazon, but hopefully they'll get that sorted out.
Well, it's great news. It's great news to hear that your book's doing so well, because, of course, Nmap is probably the single most used tool by everyone in the security industry. I mean, it's been around forever. I think the only thing that comes even close would probably be Metasploit, which is the new kid on the block. But in terms of port scanning, I mean, it's pretty much been you. I mean, you haven't really made any money directly out of Nmap, have you?
Oh, thanks, Patrick. It is a really good tool. As a moneymaker, it can be difficult, given that it's free, you know, even with millions of users. That doesn't help so much. There has been some revenue from, like, ad sales on the web, and we do have a licensing program for companies that want to embed it within their products.
Have many companies taken you up on that?
A surprising number. It was never something I intended in the first place or had even thought of, but companies started contacting me many years ago saying they wanted this, and so now there are more than 50 licensees, from big companies like Cisco and Symantec and IBM to, you know, a whole bunch of little startups that use Nmap in sort of unique ways.
So you actually make a full-time living out of Nmap these days, I guess.
I do, and we even have one full-time developer.
That's cool, and I imagine over the years you would have learned a lot about IP stacks.
Yes, that's one thing I've gotten quite familiar with, and so my goal was to kind of share everything I've learned about security scanning in the last 11 years developing Nmap in this book.
Okay, well, look, I want to talk now a little bit about Nmap and more specifically about Zenmap, because you've released a whole new swag of goodies, haven't you?
Yes, we're pretty excited about Zenmap. Nmap, as you might know, has traditionally been a command line tool. I mean, we had the Nmap FE, you know, front end, but frankly, it was kind of crappy in a lot of respects. It's the sort of thing that gives GUIs a bad name, because it was basically just, you know, have a button for SYN scan instead of, you know, typing SS option, and then just show the output in a little window. And so it's really a very thin shell that doesn't really provide many advantages. With Zenmap, we've tried to really show how the graphical interface can be an advantage in some ways. So it allows you to, it actually parses the results instead of just showing the plain text output. So you can sort them, you can search them, say, show me all the Windows machines. You can take a scan you did of your network from yesterday or last week and compare it to one today and say, show me all the differences. And we even have some new graphical features. If you're going to call it the NMAP, the network mapper, it ought to be able to draw you a map of the network. And so now it can.
Yeah, now this is something that impressed some friends of mine, because you released this quite quietly a few months ago, and I remember having a mate play with it and say, man, you've got to talk about this on the podcast because, you know, it's a GUI, but it's really good. And yeah, it automatically draws all your topology and all of that sort of stuff, doesn't it? And it can give you some quite complicated graphs.
Yeah, it uses an interesting method designed by a developer in Argentina that he called it radial map, because it shows the source address in the center of your scan, and then it has concentric circles around that, each representing one network hop. So you can easily see, you know, which hosts are on the same network because they're often on the same concentric circle. And then you can click on any host and get more information on it, or redraw the network to make that host be in the center if that visualization works better. Mm. Or you can say, hey, scan this host further, or scan more machines and add them to this existing network map.
Do you think people out there, do you think there's enough awareness out there about the fact that ZenMap is actually really good? Because, I mean, is it being downloaded a stack, or has it yet to catch on?
That could be a challenge, because I think there are a lot of users out there who are like sysadmins who've been using NMAP for a decade, and some of them haven't really paid much attention to the release notes and new features since, you know, the 1990s. And so they often come to me with questions. They'll say, hey, you know, NMAP's great, but it's sort of obsolete, because how do you know, you know, just because port 22 is open, who knows that it's really SSH? Someone could put a web server there, or file sharing. And it's like, you know, we added version detection in 4 years ago that will interrogate those ports and say, hey, you know, this is this release of OpenSSH in this version, or this is, you know, Apache web server or whatnot running on this port. And in the same way, I think there are a lot of people who've been using the command line version so long, and maybe back when they tried the graphical interface, it was in the NMAP FE days, that you're right, they're not so aware that NMAP has these new capabilities and this new graphical interface.
Well, I do remember when the first sort of versions of NMAP, you know, were made GUI-like. And as you said, you know, it wasn't really that good, was it?
No.
Do you sort of sometimes still have a few regrets about that? You just sort of go, oh, that was pretty bad.
Yes, I do. It wasn't really such a focus at the time. Mm. And, I mean, honestly, even I usually still use, you know, NMAP on the command line most of the time. But there are a lot of situations where, you know, I do now jump to ZenMap in particular.
Well, yeah.
If I want to draw one of these graphs, if I want to search the results better, if I want to compare results better, you know, ZenMap just makes it a lot easier to do.
Yeah, well, the guys I know who really like ZenMap are pen testers. You know, they say that it's actually, you can do stuff with it which will save you time over using the command line thing. So I guess it is something that you use in tandem with NMAP, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. And also Windows users find it advantageous because, you know, let's be realistic, the Windows shell, you know, sucks and has nothing compared to, you know, the Unix shells. So unless you set up your system with Sigwin and Bash and
yeah,
all of that.
Yeah, but then you've got all sorts of problems with your IP stack, right?
You can, although with Sigwin and Bash, I normally am able to use NMAP just fine.
Mm-mm. I remember using NMAP on Windows years and years ago, and it just would never quite give you the same results, I think, because it was a little bit impeded by some of the interesting non-RFC-conforming bits of the Windows IP stack.
Yeah, Microsoft can definitely be a big problem that way, especially, you know, with Windows XP SP2 when they just blatantly disabled raw IP header sending.
Well, that was because Steve Gibson at the time was jumping up and down and saying raw sockets were going to end the universe as we knew it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think he does Well, he takes credit because he's happy for this this change. But considering how Unix and, you know, BSD and Mac OS X and all these other operating systems have had, you know, raw socket operations forever, and yet they aren't plagued by as much of the worms and viruses that we see on Windows, you know, I think it's unfair to blame raw IP sockets for that.
Yeah, no, it did seem a bit of a weird scenario, that one. Now, of course, if we're going to speak about well-known, and you know, in every interview, I'm sure this comes up, if we're going to talk about well-known users of Nmap, the number one best-known user of Nmap would have to be Trinity in The Matrix.
Yes, absolutely. That was some of the biggest press we've gotten.
And that was in Matrix 2, was it?
Right, it was in Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah. No, I remember this was when Trinity was, like, hacking into some power station or whatever and actually used Nmap on the screen. You must have been thrilled by that.
I was, and I didn't even know it would happen. I just went to the midnight showing of the movie because, you know, heck, it's The Matrix with my buddy. And I saw after she rode her motorcycle down to the power station complex and beat up a bunch of guards. Then she comes to the computer, and I'm like, oh, no, not another hacking scene. These are always so stupid. And then she whips out Nmap and hacks in through an SSH vulnerability. And so it was like, wow, you know, they actually did it right. I was unsure if I actually saw what I think I thought I saw, so I had to ask my friend James, did she just use Nmap there?
Yeah, no, I remember we spoke about this years ago, and by the time you'd gotten home, people had already taken photos of it and emailed them to you.
Yeah, I was starting to get screenshots and people smuggling cameras in to take pictures.
And you've got some of those pictures in the book, right? Much to the objections of Warner Brothers.
The publisher I was going to go with insisted that I ask permission to put them in. So I sent them emails and faxes and physical mails, and finally they responded. But it was basically just a hell no, you IP pirate. You know, they worded it politely, like, we would really love to be able to let you do this, but unfortunately our policies prohibit it. And so I thought that was pretty obnoxious of them. You know, they'll go use Nmap in their movie without, you know, any notification or credit or permission or anything. But I just want to use a screenshot of that scene, and they're like, no way.
So did you put it in the book anyway?
Yes, I dumped the potential publisher and stuck it in the book anyway.
Excellent. Sticking it to the man, Fyodor.
Indeed. Now, somehow I don't think they're going to read the Nmap book all that much. So,
all right. Well, Gordon Lyon, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
Oh, thank you, Patrick.
Gordon Fyodor Lyon on the line there from the USA. And if you want to find his book, you can go to our website, itradio.com.au/security, and find the link to this podcast. And there'll be a link in there to the Amazon page for his book. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview with RSA Security's Greg Singh. Without our sponsors, there is simply no Risky Business. So as regular listeners know, we get our sponsors on the show each week to have a yarn about some current events. And this week, we're talking to Greg Singh about a survey put together by another man, Nigel Fair, who was formerly the team leader of investigations at the Australian High Tech Crime Centre. Nigel's an AFP agent and author who's written a book about computer crime, which is called Cybercrime: The Reality of the Threat. And his interest in the subject has led him to this latest project, a survey all about the everyday person's attitude towards computer security and privacy. There were 680 respondents to this survey, and Greg, one of the funniest findings that I found was the statistic on internet banking. 68% of respondents said they had trust and confidence with internet banking. Now, that might sound great, but what really surprises me is that 32% of respondents don't have trust with internet banking.
Yeah, that is a little bit surprising, I guess. I mean, it's a fairly high number too when you look at it. But I think when you look at the press and that, you do actually see incidents popping up of things that have gone wrong in internet banking. And not only that, people tend to know someone where something's gone wrong with their internet banking, like they might have been hacked or phished in some sort of way. And quite often it's a social networking thing where it's, you know, like, my friend, did you know what happened?
Yeah, I can only assume the same thing, that it's some sort of grapevine thing. But I wonder if the banks are doing a good enough job at getting the message out there that their funds are actually covered. Because in Australia, if someone actually gets into your internet banking account and starts transferring money out, they'll cover the loss.
That's correct, yeah. Now, Australian banks are very good like that, where they will cover the loss. Obviously, you need to prove that it's not you, and obviously they're being milked out for some sort of mule account or it's some sort of laundering exercise is happening. So obviously, if you're not responsible for those payments, you are protected. And people do realise that, I think, but I think also, like, people can feel somewhat violated in the fact that even though they are protected in the background, they still don't want it to happen to them.
Mm-mm. Now, another statistic that I found quite interesting in this is half of the respondents said that they'd received a phishing email and 1% said that they'd actually sent the information requested by the sender. So that means that there are still a lot of people out there who are prepared to give up their passwords and their logins.
Yeah, absolutely consistent with our studies as well, which shows that phishing still returns enough results for the fraudsters to make it a worthwhile exercise for them.
But it is somewhat surprising, isn't it? Because phishing is hardly new.
I think what we're starting to see, and increasingly more so, is that the phishing attacks are getting more and more sophisticated. And when I say sophisticated, it's really the same old idea that's sort of gone to a slightly different level, where they're getting complete replicas of the actual banking site, and they look exactly like your normal banking site. In a lot of ways, they actually link back to the actual banking site. So if you hit maybe the policy or the terms and conditions,
yeah,
it'll actually link you to your real bank.
Yeah, yeah. But still, you know, I mean, that's not the point, is it? We've been trying to educate people for years and years and years that you should never respond to those sort of emails, no matter how genuine they look. And it seems that the message isn't getting through to everyone. But I suppose, you know, there's just some people who aren't plugged into the media, aren't necessarily going to be privy to that sort of information. I mean, I know plenty of people who don't watch TV, don't read the newspapers, you know?
Well, that's right. I mean, what you're really saying to people is that here's a valid form of communication where you can talk to your friends, your family, and other people that that you might consider having correspondence with. But if it's from your bank, you should be suspicious. And that is somewhat a convoluted message for society. And it's probably more of a social implication, something that we need to solve at a social level more than just the banks trying to solve it for themselves.
We need to make everyone paranoid, I think is the...
I think everyone needs to have a level of paranoia that perhaps they don't have at the moment.
Well, this is something that I've discussed with Nigel on many occasions, is the whole nature of this online crime. And I've also discussed this with Alastair McGibbon, who used to be with the Australian High Tech Crime Centre, and these days, I believe, he's still the Chief Security Officer or Trust and Safety Officer for eBay in Australia. And, you know, he says if a bloke walks up to you and says, hey, give me $500 and I'm going to nip out the bank, grab you a plasma TV and I'll be back in 10 minutes. You're going to tell him to get stuffed. But yet, this is the type of fraud that you see on the internet.
That's correct, yeah. Now, people don't realise that it's just like standing out on the street. And, you know, you can be approached by people. And if someone was to put on, say, for instance, a uniform of a police officer or something, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are one.
Yeah. Now, this, there's the whole thing. If you go to go to knock on someone's door and say you're a police officer and you show them some form of ID that says you are, I would hazard a guess that most people wouldn't even know what a police identification badge or identification card would actually look like. So, you know.
That's but true.
Another headline figure here out of the survey that I found quite interesting is that 53% of respondents to Nigel's survey had a personal profile on an online social networking site, but less than half of them, of the people who did have profiles, actually set their profile for public view. So this is interesting, isn't it? Where some messages just aren't getting across, but others are, because I was quite surprised by that only 43% of people with social networking sites would allow strangers to view them.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously, I think it's a good trend for people to turn that sort of stuff off. I mean, share it with your friends, okay. But you should maintain a level of privacy about who you are, because the people that are looking at this information aren't necessarily just those, you know, long-lost school friends, you know, that are trying to find you. They're fraudsters that are quite often looking for personally identifiable information where they might be able to form an identity and then maybe do some bad things against you.
I guess I don't know whether or not they're blocking their profiles from being viewed for security reasons, though. I suspect it's more to do with privacy. So, you know, it is interesting that people are prepared to take steps to protect and safeguard their privacy, but not necessarily to protect and safeguard their security, to the same extent anyway.
And I really think the two should go hand in hand.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is not a new philosophy. I mean, this has been around for a long time, I guess. But
I think as time goes by and potentially more online crime, happens, out there in the real world, I think people will become more aware of it, especially as it hopefully hits the media and people get that form of awareness.
All right, well, Greg Singh, that takes us to the end of
Patrick.
Our interview and the show, and thank you very much for your contributions.
A pleasure. Thank you, Patrick.
RSA Securities' Greg Singh there on the line with this week's sponsor interview, and you can find a link to the survey we were just discussing at itradio.com.au/security. And that takes us to the close of another edition of Risky Business. We'll be back next week with a special Year in Review podcast for you all to have a listen to. This week's Sound Foundation track is Keep It Real by Ash Grunwald, and you can buy it at soundfoundation.com.au. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. When you don't have nobody, can't help but keep it real. No, you don't have to worry, you just got to do your